Hello and welcome to Social Justice Matters, the podcast from Social Justice Ireland. If you're tuning in regularly, you'll know that our podcasts come in three different formats. We have our 10-minute lesson series, we have our seminar series, and then we have our interview series. This week it's an interview. I'm delighted to be joined by Paul Uzel and Dan Kenningham from All Together in Dignity, which is ATD Ireland. Paul and Dan, you don't hear much of Dan now, to be fair, in this. Paul and Dan they chat with me about the origins of the organisation, the aims and the core work of the organisation, and they are part of a coalition to add the 10th, which is a campaign to see socioeconomic status recognised as the 10th ground of discrimination in Irish equality legislation. We hope you enjoy. So again, firstly, thank you very much. I will endeavour to pronounce ATD correctly because I seem to have defaulted to the wrong way around. So I'm going to do my very best with that. I'll begin where we always do, which is the organisation that you both work for. If you can give me a part of history, I'm conscious it's an interesting enough story that I'd be interested to hear how the whole thing began.
So the history of ATD would go back to the post-Second World War era. So we had a lot of refugees, obviously, all across Europe. Within France, camp was set up by just people fleeing war-torn areas. They settled together in Nozay-le-Grand was the name of the camp. And within this camp, there was a breakdown in everything, you know what I mean? Social order, so they're doing like no more drinking. There's no work, there's no nothing going on. There was a lot of surviving, just like making money from what you could. There was a tendency from a lot of the locals, local villages, didn't kind of like having them on their doorstep. There was, I think, a bit of animosity started, and there was tensions within two kind of cultures that was pre-existing one, and then this new one kind of moving in. There was a priest, Father Joseph Rosensky. I think he volunteered, yeah, for a parish priest for that area, a job that no one wanted them to do it, you know, because a few charities had tried to go in, and they were just like, "No, these people aren't ready for any of us," you know, because it was quite wild. And you understand the history of the times, you kind of understand the history of the people as well. A lot of them probably were ex-soldiers, or just everyone was traumatized, I'd say, to some level or another. As I said, Father Joseph Rosensky, he went in there, and he was very much a rebel. Outlook was, "We're going to develop a charity, we'll develop it ourselves. So, like, we have our own abilities, we have our own skills." He wanted to instill a form of education for them to recognize their already acquired skills. So, the women welcomed him, interestingly enough, and the men were opposed to him because he was kind of highlighting their tendencies to, I suppose, think or just switch off. A lot of that would have been going on. They had their struggles initially, which is understandable. But when they started to realise that he was more to their side than he was to the system, say, because they had a lot of problems with the system wanting to move them on, and there was always some official coming down with something or another, and they never really had that representation. There wasn't anyone there, I think, confident enough or had the ability to, yeah, the legal speak or anything like that, you know, the terminology would be going over their head. But all of a sudden, they had the advocate that was Father Joseph. He got the people to come together. He formed meetings. Four few were quite rowdy. He was thrown out. He was threatened with everything. But eventually, the people started to trust him because he lived among them. And there's a video out there. It's called Father Joseph, the Rebel. And it's actually, you get to see how he was living in the conditions that the people were living in as well. And it was kind of like swamp. Like there was no footpaths. There was no light, and there was no nothing. So you had a complete breakdown of what we would call social cohesion. But he was the one that helped install it again, bring it into the let the people know, not let the people know, but bring their awareness to their talents, their natural abilities. He had mechanics amongst the men. He had carpenters amongst the men. He had electricians amongst the men. So there was possibilities. You know what I mean? Like if you just needed that kind of leader, someone to kind of give them that little oomph and show them the emphasis on certain things. The history stems from there. His struggles, his own organization, the church, which didn't like what he was doing because it was more successful than the model of going to church and putting your tithes into a box, I suppose. Whereas he was more in favor of building up the people, and we don't want charity. We don't want handouts because The danger, I strongly believe in anyway, with too much charity is if it's withdrawn, you're snookered. Like, where'd you go? It's like giving someone a walking stick and then just kicking it from underneath them, wondering why they're falling. So that would have been his intention, was that he was going to empower the people, build them up, so that they could do all this stuff themselves and not be as reliant upon a system that didn't really want them there in the first place anyway.
That's key, isn't it? Like it's harnessing the skills that are already within the community.
Yeah, well, it's like the same thing. We were only talking, we were at an event in Trinity College recently, and we've done a talk a lot about education, and education isn't to instill, it's to draw it out already within. I think that was the key role that he played there. He drew out what the people already had, their natural abilities, their talents. Or if they didn't realize they had a talent, he showed them, like, no, that is a talent. It's transferable. It can become a commodity. There's a possibility that you can earn a living from this or whatever way. So we, our kind of model here is very similar. Which are trying to give people that ability, or not, sorry, ability, the recognition of their abilities, so that they can go out and do their own thing in life, so that they can go out and get an education if that's what they want. If they want to get a job, if they just don't want to do anything, they're just happy in themselves, whatever they're doing. But as I said, when people come here, we're us forces to recognize them as a human being, and that they are of importance. You know what I mean? They are somebody, and I think that's the message that I would have taken from the history as I learned it. I'd rather see people built up than taken down, So the history is very much the present at ATD. I don't think the formula would have changed much. I mean, it could be anyone that's in any of the teams around the world or whatever. We were inspired by Father Joseph, by his ethos, you know what I mean, by his philosophy. It'd be very similar today, the history. I mean, we've moved on with technology and all that sort of nonsense, but like at the heart of it, the message is still the same,
Okay. What's the main focus of your work now at the moment?
The moment we are trying to get this at the tent. I mean, that's the tenth round of a quality legislation, which is socio-economic discrimination, a word I ban or despise. For me, it sounds like it's on most people's heads anyway. We're working on that, and we try to use the creative manner in that their activists or people that we bring into meetings or whatever we're holding. We're holding an open day here, which we do most Tuesdays, and we try and get people that normally don't speak. And I mean, don't speak. You come in, you might get hello out of them and nothing else. But once they start getting involved in the creative process, they're asking for a mark, or give us this, give us that. And before you know it, bits and pieces and banter starts to fly across, and people come alive a bit. I always remember there's three techniques to education. So we're not, and you can't just educate people in one way. You can't just speak into them and expect them to be to pick up what you're saying. Some people don't learn that way. Some people learn by hearing, feeling, and doing. So it's kinetics, I think they call it. It's the final one, the doing part. So we do that here, that we try and get people to just get involved. If they're not, they don't want to get involved in the art part, they might do the cooking for the day, but they're doing that. They'll wash the delf, for the there's something for you to do. You could be the DJ. Dan's usually the DJ, so the taste of music's terrible. No, but that's some of the things. So you're trying to get people there. Involved in one manner or another. So it is inclusive.
That community thing is valid, really important. And as you said, just being heard is really important, isn't it?
We would have our own little community here, but Dan mentioned community development, and to me, that's what it is, because you're trying to develop, because these people are going to go back out into the broader community anyway, which is their own family, their own immediate circle. And you'd like to think that they can have some sort of impact, especially if they found the voice, the place, like to stand on their own 2 feet. If they can carry an argument with most, they can carry an argument with most people. So,
I
that's kind
think,
of.
yeah, you're right though. Like the term socioeconomic discrimination is it's hard to say and it can be sometimes hard to understand. So a lot of the work you've done is really about What do we actually mean by socioeconomic discrimination? So, like the sort of stories that you can tell, can you give us a flavor of what this means in people's day-to-day lives?
I think very start, we had a lot of problems trying to transfer this to people. I even had issues with myself. I was like, what are we using this term for? Like, don't know what people's heads. It's very legal, the wording. So we would use analogies, as in like traffic lights. If we didn't have traffic lights, we'd all be speeding through the bleeding straight down the road and crashing into each other. We mightn't like them, but they're there for a reason. So we would explain how adding the tent could be a form of as a traffic light, or having hazard lights in the car, indicators. You can use them as tools to show people the way to go. That would be one way we would try and do it. We'd try and break it down, simplify it. I'd use the actual phrase socioeconomic discrimination and try and bring it down to the simplest term I can find, which would be you don't like wearing a seatbelt, but you wear one because it makes sense. You know what I mean? And it's the same sort of thing. No one wanted to wear a seatbelt. Same with the drink driving laws. To drive home with 8 points and it come down to two. And there's reasons for that. And the same thing with adding this tenth ground. There's a reason for it. You mightn't see it initially. And in the phrase socio-economic discrimination, I think most people do not see it. So that's where we try and simplify it. Use examples. We've had people who've brought attention to, say, in shops. They were in going walking around shops doing their own business, and they drew attention to the security man or whatever. They'd say, like, what am I getting followed for? Why am I being picked? Why am I being highlighted? And they would actually quote not the social economic discrimination, but they'd use something similar from what we've been saying. So you wouldn't do that against someone else. Is it because of the way I look or whatever? So they're starting to get an understanding. The more you know, the better you're prepared. The social economic discrimination, they wouldn't have understood it. And I mean, like, I struggle with it all the time. But to try and break it down into layman's terms where you can transfer what you're trying to say to someone quite easily, that's what we would do an awful lot. I mean, we've done it through, as I said, through art, through development projects. Like this, for an example, I don't know if you can see that. It's probably on the,
I'll
it's
put a
no
link to
use.
that. So no, that's grand. So what I'll do is this is your publication called Breaking Barriers, and I'm going to put a link to that then in the notes. So there'll be people will be able to find that. What page are you looking at specifically there?
Page five was where it
Okay.
started. It's definition in real terms is the headline, and someone gave a quote. People treat us differently because of how we look, how we speak, where we live, and our wealth. Toxic, and it impacts our quality of life. There's just a graphic, and it's a picture of a jigsaw, the missing piece, as we call it, at the tent, the missing piece. And it's just, what does social economic discrimination mean? And it's just left on a table, and people can write on it. And then we have like just one example. Someone wrote envy. A lot of people wrote toxic human beings, or I actually remember who wrote that. Else wrote hurtful, mentioned the class systems. There was all different people's different experiences.
That's probably the
One.
valid bit, is that this has real life impact. It's not an academic term. It's not something that is just in a book somewhere. This has a really detrimental impact on people's opportunities, on their physical and mental health, on how they move through the world. So this is very real for a lot of people, isn't it?
Yeah, especially when I read some of the quotes that people had left on there. I was actually taken aback. I was just like, oh, we didn't see it from that perspective. And I thought I understood it a lot better than most people would have. And I assumed why people, like, one woman was powerless. Just in general, like, it's toxic. Why would you put someone in that frame of mind? Why would you? You know what I mean? Are you getting something from it? And did they explain it better than I can anyway, but
In terms of like that equality of opportunity, as you said, allowing people to be able to sort of push past that, if that's what you would hope this legislation would do.
yeah, you're hoping that it would encourage people to put the seatbelt on or cut the speed limit, you know what I mean? Just so it's in their mind. It's culture. It changed within the culture, a shift within the culture. And that doesn't happen overnight. We're just briefly talking about, like, the way the internet come up with that word Karen to explain someone. We're just talking about it will be the Karens of the world who would say to people, "Hey, you can't do that." But in a good way, you know what I mean? Like, no, you're not like around the water cooler when people are gathered around the water cooler, the coffee machine, wherever at lunch, you're chatting about such and such over in the corner there. And poor such and such doesn't interact with anyone else, and no one thinks it's a problem. But there will always be a Karen that'll step up and go, "No, that's wrong. Maybe Karen is the wrong name, but
But no,
you're the
you're
Dan."
right. Like, so, somebody who's not, who sees it and isn't afraid to call it out. And I think that's, and it is that slow, gradual process that I just had a conversation about an hour ago of the types of things that you were able to say in the 80s that you simply cannot say now. So it's that gradual shift. So this piece of legislation, I suppose, would quicken that process, you'd hope.
Give people ammunition, should I say, or a tool. So if enough people are using this tool, other people will realize that this tool is in existence, and I don't want to fall foul of it. A lot of people are good people, and they'll just correct themselves automatically. That's why you put the seat belt on. That's why you don't break the red light. That's why you don't speed. It just becomes almost becomes habit. I'm a strong believer in, like, we're a very small country. We're not resource rich. I believe we are. Our richest resources are people. I don't understand the government's policy or the position. I'd be educating people to the highest standard, to the max. You know what I mean? We haven't got gold in the ground, but we've gold within our people. We could look at a lot of things. Like, one of the campaigns we would have done before, was a few years ago, was about housing, and the situation's just got worse since then. And it's the same kind of thing when this becomes, if it becomes a law, it's a tool. Then it's the mind that's welding it. Like, it's the head that's using the tool, that otherwise would be just knocking chips out or something. You have to know what you're doing to craft something with it. With the tool, you have to not be able to use it, and that's where I think the law, clever lawyers will come in. Like, we'd have a the likes of Flack, really, like a legal aid centre. We have others. We probably have the likes of yourself. You'll see, oh, there's something now. You found something. You know that I can use this now as a wedge to get me in here, push back against this. But if we don't have it, we cannot use it. I mean, like, it's like having this the car with no seatbelts. It's, you know what I mean, like, there's nothing. There's no restraint there.
And I know you had said something very interesting the last time we spoke on this, which is that we appreciate that there's nine other grounds, but that this tenth one sort of underpins and strengthens all of the other ones.
Because I've seen people discriminated against for what we would say socioeconomic discrimination, say, applying for a job or whatever it is, or wanting housing or whatever, just coming up against the system and getting just a knockback. They were supposedly in a protected category of nine. When it comes to this position, you can basically, I'm discriminating against you, and there's no comeback. You know what I mean? And you can try and say, "Oh, it's because of my age, or me this or that," and it might just be because, no, they just see it as a different class. You don't have money.
I suppose the other thing that I suppose I'm interested in is, can we compare this to anybody else, any other countries? Is there anybody else doing anything in this space that we can look at?
France does it differently than us. They've totally different way of operating. But that's a cultural thing. That's why legally, as in this kind of framework, this project being picked up, I think Belgium is probably a better example of it, to see where it's going. And I think there's a lot of, because it's fairly recent. I think there's a lot of people, like, starting the initial process of the legal framework, getting it up and going, trying to get it into courts, because it is going to be a difficult thing to kind of prove. But we're not arguing that we want to see everyone in court. This is working, no one will be in court. This won't happen. I can put my earphones in and they're not even on. I walk down the road and I don't bother anyone. You know what I mean? Like, I just put them on just as a signal to just let me be and just go on about my business. And I think more and more that would become the norm. Because no one wants to go to court. Only crazy people, let's be honest, want to go to court, because there's nothing in it for you. There's not too many positive outcomes going to court. And the average person, it does not want to be the person in work talked about, "Oh, you're up in court, you're up in court." Next minute, you're named and shamed, you know, which no one wants that either. But if that's where it takes, that's where it takes. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it shouldn't be happening. These opportunities that, like, we were in Trinity the other day, and it's similar to this, but it's we're talking about how the creative process, how we use it in empower our activists, and how our activists show our power for themselves through the creative process, where they first learn to speak out and find voice. But we're in Trinity, and we're just talking. I was talking about from Trinity to the public. There's a gap. Something's missing. Because what's being taught in the institutions should be coming out and becoming it should fit, be fitting within society. Right? So in other words, the services should reflect what's being taught in the recent institutions. So if they're being taught excellence in them buildings and they're coming out into the public sphere, where's it falling down? If you understand me, because I personally believe, I've been to college a few times, and I've listened to a lot of what was being said, and I was like, people are so far off the mark. It's unreal. Like, for me, it was a lot of unexperienced people talking about the experience. Okay, and that's very hard to transfer to someone. It's very hard to educate someone about it. It's like me trying to tell someone about the war, and I haven't left this office. So,
So representation matters.
yeah, definitely.
And if I can pick up on that point, because that's, I know again, it's something you've spoken about before, which I find fascinating, which is that thing about knowledge and whose knowledge is weighted, whose knowledge is more important. And it always seems to be the academic. No offense to any academics, we work with academics, we love academics, they do great work. But it's just that thing of whose your lived experience has to count for something. And a lot of these conversations doesn't even get in, it doesn't even get into the room, never mind be given equal weight. So like that's a really that's a big part of the work you do as well, isn't it? Just making sure that people have agency and that their lived experience is given at least equal weight.
Yeah, well, we've been trying to force that for a long time into different institutions, but we've found allies, believe me, some good allies, and they would be they'd be very like-minded to ourselves, and they would be academic. So it's not all bad. Like, I'm not saying that the institutions are terrible, and that's where we go with the shared knowledge approach, that the academic, the activist, and then the person with the lived experience, who usually could be an activist anyway, come together. But when, especially when policy is being constructed or formed or whatever, sometimes when I'm reading these pieces of paper or I hear this new law change or something, I was going, who was in that room? Like, who seriously didn't, like, someone had to have said, that ain't going to work. You're making decisions for people who aren't even in the room. It's like operating on me. I'm not there. Not in the equation. I can tell you things that ain't gonna happen. Gonna walk. You're gonna waste millions of pounds sticking that in the corner over there, because that's where such and such. We know the way how these communities work, or from them. We've lived in them, so we know what's lacking. We know what's needed. Dear, well, I would try and do a lot of peer work here. It's just pulling someone aside, and it's coming along. We'd say coming alongside them, and it's giving them support, and it's highlighting, like, when you see something, say, that's very unique what you have there, that's a bit of a talent there, maybe you should look into it or whatever. So you're not putting someone down, you know what I mean? You're trying to constantly build people up, because society or whatever, not so far in life, has pushed them down. And you mentioned it as well, that can ruin someone's day, it can ruin their week, their month, whatever. And there might only be a few words. People might think that's nothing. Well, a lot of us have trouble looking in the mirror, be honest. We have to put makeup on us or whatever. So we have to feel comfortable going out. And it's not nice then if you go out and face all this. People might say it's a perceived attack, but it's not. Well, to me, it's not. And if you're talking about someone who's already in a low position, has a lot of self-doubt, a lot of going on up here, they're easily targeted. They're extremely vulnerable. And they're open to all kinds of stuff, you know. We would have an understanding around that. A lot of people would fall into addiction, depression, and everything that goes with it. So it isn't a good place. And people might think, does it make sense? What is that going to do with, for someone? But if someone knows that they have a tool to use, they will use it. But there's nothing worse than being unarmed, you know what I mean? Like,
Well, I think there's nothing worse than being put into a box, and there's nothing worse than being put into the wrong box. somebody deciding who you are simply based on your accent or the way you look or the way you dress is damaging because you're not being seen as an individual. As you said, you're being seen as a type or as a cliche or as a not as yourself, not as you said, not as a human being, and certainly not as a unique personality. The other thing I think that was fascinating about the, as you said, using it as a tool was that communities could use it as well. So it wasn't just a thing of I've been discriminated against, I'm going to sue whoever, but that communities could maybe use it to say, well, we're being prejudiced against based on these, as you said, class factors in our area that you could maybe hold, systems could hold other systems to account.
I'm delighted you said that now, because all along that would be my main goal. It's not for individuals, it's to go after the institutions so that the change comes from the top all the way down. And exactly like what you said, that people can get together in a group and say, yeah, well, we've only got one school, or we've three schools and one crossing, or we don't have this, or we don't have that. All these other communities seem to have it. Now they can turn around and say, well, we've got money. You say, well, what's that mean? Because you've more money, so you're going to have a better society than us. Well, in other words, yeah, but basically what you're saying to us is, no, you need to get the same money as us to have the quality of life that we have. We're trying to get into the mind. That's where the culture shift would happen. If you're in that position of a power structure, you're at the top. You don't really think about the people below you until you actually come across them. We've had encounters with people that would say, PDs, whatever, power brokers, gatekeepers, whatever you want to call them. At first, I would have been like, this is total, I'm not going to get anywhere with this thing. This was my perception from what I've probably seen of them in the media. And no, I'm thinking straight out, oh, this is going to be an argument to try and even get engaged in this conversation. Talking to them 2, 3 minutes, bump the human. And they're like, what? And as if it's, something's being brought to their attention for the very first time. That's what it's. I felt personally. On several occasions, that's what it felt like, that this person was actually, for the first time, actually hearing the examples of policy failure or gaps within the system, things that aren't working. And it genuinely, I felt like they never heard this before. But we try and bring them that awareness, to try and bring the awareness. Or I do find when you bring the person who has the lived experience to the person that you want, who has the ability to change someone's experience. Not all the time, but most times I've been quite surprised by the fact that they're so open to it. It was like as if they didn't know this was going on at all. It wasn't like, a lot of it wasn't like deliberately, like they were hiding behind cloaks or anything.
As you said, I mean, it's that knowledge piece, isn't it? Sometimes if you're just looking at statistics and it'll say, 97% of Irish children leave school at secondary, at leaving cert level, and you go, well, that's brilliant. That's a real success story. But then if you don't go back and focus on the 3% and who are they and why are they not getting to leaving cert, it's probably going back and filling in the gaps for people really and saying, well, actually, hang on a second, which probably brings me nicely then into that concept of the furthest behind first, which I know you've worked upon with sort of the sustainable development goals and that type of thing. Can you just give us again just a very quick flavor of the types of things that you do there?
So with the SDGs, Sustainable Development Goals, right, 17 of them, and it's very ambitious. Well, let's be honest. In the ideal world, we'd have it anyway. Me personally, I tend to focus on no poverty, because I believe if there's no poverty, nothing else would kind of exist. If that makes any meaning or any sense to you.
Totally. I
So.
think that underpins, it's very, very difficult, I think, to argue for bringing your plastic bottles back to the shop to be recycled if you're living in homeless accommodation with two small kids. So all of that sort of sustainability, the decent transport, the decent cities, if people don't have enough. But I think it's number one for a reason, I think, that
Yeah. Well,
everything else builds upon that. I completely agree with you.
we've gone into the reeds with people, like into the long water, into the deep water, and people have different perceptions and different ideas and this and that. And I says, I'm not going there, because some people are just thinking is way out there. Whereas for me, no poverty would help eliminate the other. Yeah, not every one of them, but it would make an awful lot of them redundant anyway. Because Like what you said, even the simple act of going to the bottle bank, there's so many people not going to do that. And even in doing it, funnily enough, right, talking about the way the machine spits it out, it has to be perfect. And you're like, what's all this about? And then I'm there going, I'm not saying nothing about the SDGs. You know what I mean? You're not in a queue full of angry shoppers anyway. You know what I mean? Like trying to explain themselves to them. But I mean, like if you're earning a certain wage per week, that's not an issue for you. You don't care whether the bottles get recycled or not. You know what I mean? Like, oh, look, I'm doing a good thing for the planet. So you're seen to be doing something. People who I know countless people who genuinely an extra 40 or 50 quid a week would make the difference between them having a good week or a bad week. And that's the way it goes for them. I won't light the fire, or I won't do this, I won't put the heating on, I won't do this. They wait till Thursday to do this, so that these are decisions they're having to make all the time. And then you add in on top of that, then open discrimination in certain areas, and you're like, oh, what's this all about?
Things are
Do you
tough
know what I mean?
enough as
Like,
it is, yeah.
and then like we've a lot of young people, as I said. With me anyway, I'd be geared towards working with youth. It's easier when people are younger and they have that ambition and hope and they're full of drive anyway. They have the energy, you know that way. There's a young guy who could make an example of that. He does amazing work in the community. He's only 17 going on 18. Okay? And he goes out of his way to do boxing with young people. And it's in a very deprived area. Terrible, it has a terrible reputation. And he goes out of his way to train kids. He's only put himself in boxing, keeping fit, getting a routine. And all these people are starting bit by bit. They're going off into looking into nutrition, sports psychology. And this stems from this one person he took on his own back. And he is harassed by the police for no other reason. No other reason. He'd be coming home after doing what he's had to be doing with them, and he'd stop him. And he'd stop him, and he'd stop him on his way, and he'd stop him on his way back again. You look like someone, you look suspicious, whatever. And not only that, they get out and search him. That's against the law. We just know the law. So they would talk him into things. Like I spoke to him a few times and said, you don't have to engage in them. You don't have to explain where you're going. This is your community. This is your house. That would not happen in other communities. It just wouldn't happen.
What's the next steps then, I suppose, for you as an organization in terms of adding the tent? What's on the cards for 2024?
We've done a lot of work with the colleges recently. We only done a project there the other day, Creative Pathways to Participation. So that was the creative process as well. But what the hope would be, we all have a past, okay? A lot of people have a past that was horrific, okay? And it participate within society because they hadn't got the ability to see beyond that. And in their head, they think everyone knows. Everyone's going to know what happened to me in my past, and that's just the reality of it. I'm trying to get people to acknowledge the actual things they've achieved now. We've addressed the UN. We've spoke at major events in Europe and in Ireland, international events. We've led and facilitated projects or created the design for something, layout of a book. We're doing a book at the moment, as it says, Creative Pathways to Participation, is it? A bit long-winded. Dan loves them, these ones. No. But you have to use this language. But you don't want people to be kind of dwelling in the past. Now, the past is the past, but it's the future and the now. And what abilities have you got now that you didn't have before you came in the door 4 or 5 years ago? As I said before, we had people would not speak beyond giving their name. They wouldn't engage in a conversation. And like some of them for 2 years, you get hello and they, yeah, whatever. Do you want a cup of tea? Yeah. That was it. Now they're actually taking lead roles. Some of them had only recently addressed the United Nations, didn't they? In a webinar, was it? Yeah. So,
I'm in New York.
And
Celebration.
yeah, and one of our activists went to New York and addressed the United Nations. I was blown away because I know him personally. I'll just say it as a quick example. He used to be bullied an awful lot. Okay. And for me, socio-economic discrimination is a form of bullying. Bullies. So I'll stand up against him. I'll be a curtain in that situation. Not a bother to me, you know. And that's how I got to know this person anyway, because I was being bullied and I stepped in and it stopped. You know what I mean? I became the traffic light. And I believe that's what would happen if this became a law. People will step in. I don't like stepping in on their own. The guards can come in on my behalf now, because there is a legality. There's an issue to be argued out in court in this around what happened or whatever. And anyway, people have confidence and ability in themselves, how they present and hold themselves and carry themselves within society. They will not tolerate bullying either. And bullying can be all forms. You're going to leave an application form in, and someone puts it to the bottom of the pile, doesn't put it in the pile. Just for no reason, just doesn't like the look of you. What we're doing, as I said, it's kind of long-winded. We're trying to get people to acknowledge their own abilities and to stand on their own 2 feet. And a lot of them do. They do, and they're still up against it. They're still up against the system. And so sometimes it's like knocking your head out a brick wall, and you're getting nowhere, you're getting nowhere. And then you get a little chink, you get a little hole in it, and a little crack, and you start to see a little bit of hope. And then someone comes over and puts a big blob of cement on it, and you start again. Sometimes it can feel like that. Sometimes it's not. And yet when I think of the people who have spoken, the places where they spoke, like I said, in the UN, you know, in New York, addressing the webinars within the UN itself again, we addressed the president, and he had to respond to the address. So that address was quite clever, the way it was worded. We had to respond to it. So that was an opportunity. We do get a chance to punch above our weight, because we're a very small team. A lot of people think that there's hundreds of us running around Ireland, when there's not. It's two or three of us.
I know that
There's
feeling.
activists. A lot of it's the power of the individual. I mean, when they realise that, if I say this, I'm not going to get into the corner. I'm going to have to drop my head and keep my eyes down low. The head's up now. Once your head's up, you're able to twist your neck and look about and see what's happening. And you're aware of stuff. And then they're aware of their own abilities as well. So that's what we hope 2024 be. And we win the lotto as well.
That is, I think that might be the best note to end it on that kind of hopeful, joyful, as you said, with a few million in the back pocket. Dan and Paul, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Thank
Susan. Thank you
you.
very much.
I hope you found that interesting and useful. There's a load of links that you can check out in the show notes, anything that Paul and Dan have referred to in the conversation. Any ideas that you might have for future conversations, any topics you'd like us to discuss or investigate further, please feel free to email us at secretary@socialjustice.ie with your thoughts. Until next time, stay safe.